We'll now be pleased to be led in a consideration of Isaiah chapter 24 by Brother Brian Luke.
Thanks, Brother Royce, and my dear brethren and sisters and class members. In our first review of chapter 24, we covered, I suppose, in general terms, the first 13 verses. So the first 12 of those were a doleful lamentation of the land that was in very sore plight. What was the heading that I gave you for those verses last time? Could somebody just read that out? I didn't retain a copy of that. Sorry, Max.
A great lament.
A great lament, yes. A doleful judgment upon the land. Incidentally, the headings for that chapter are being distributed tonight. We might get them shortly after the class, Pete. Oh, someone else got them, haven't they? Keith got them. Have you got them already? Might be good if we handed those out, I think. Yeah, why not? Thanks, Bill. Well, that's being done. We'll continue on. And do you remember how that the word Eretz was used many, many times in the chapter? And thank you. Which I mentioned last time. We're used to using that word Eretz as though it was the land of Israel, but the Hebrew word Eretz is not in any way confined to the land of Israel. And do you remember me making that point? And I stress it again, because otherwise, when you come across somebody saying, oh, this is the word Eretz here, you know, it means Israel. It doesn't mean Israel at all. The context is that which determines what it means. Eretz is used many times of land, of earth. So it's used the land of the Philistines, the land of Moab, and land of Egypt, and all sorts of other lands. The essential idea is land. So we therefore have to look at those verses and determine to ourselves, what do we think the prophet is doing? Is the prophet, has he the whole world seen? All the inhabitants of the world. Is that his vision? Or is he limiting his vision to the nation of Israel? And I suggest that the key verse in determining that is verse 5. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, and broken the everlasting covenant. And because those terms, those three things, remember there were three things, transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, and broken the everlasting covenant. Those three expressions all have a particular relevance. Some more. All have a particular relevance, don't they, to the ordinance and the laws and the covenant that was made with Israel. Especially that last expression, broken the everlasting covenant, that's particularly from Genesis chapter 17, where Abraham is promised an everlasting possession and an everlasting covenant was made. And that covenant was symbolized by the matter of circumcision. And I'm sure that when people heard the prophet mentioning these words, they would have related this first section to their own nation and to their own circumstances. And so, my dear brothers and sisters, just to go back to give that broad picture again, we have therefore the Israelites listening to the prophet Isaiah and determining in their mind what this really related to. It may be that they didn't get the whole picture on that occasion. Probably they didn't. But I'm sure they would have seen these words as related to their own circumstance. Now, what was coming up? Well, it was the judgment of Sennacherib. There was a number of judgments coming upon Israel, as we know very well. Just to get it in perspective, the first of those that was coming upon Judah was that under Sennacherib. That's a double N, by the way. Sennacherib, by the Assyrians. And then, sometime later, in the year 606, there came Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. And then, much more drastically, even yet again, in AD 70, we have the Roman invasion by Titus and Vespasian. So they are the three possibilities in applying this prophecy. And I believe that this prophecy, in fact, had its application to everyone. There's no question that people in Isaiah's day who did undergo this would have seen this prophecy in relationship to themselves. No question about it, isn't it? They would look about the circumstances that were about them and they would have said, this is all exactly like it is here. And therefore, when the Assyrians came down and they went right through their land and gave their land a hammering, they would have seen it as applying to them. But it's a difficulty.
Do you remember last time we mentioned the difficulty? It's verse 10. The city of confusion. Thank you. The city of confusion is broken down. Now, why is that a problem? If we're applying it to this circumstance. Pardon?
It just didn't happen. The Assyrians did take all the rest of the countryside, but in fact they were stopped at the walls of Jerusalem because of the wonderful prayer, inspiration, wonderful King Hezekiah, who prayed unto Yahweh, he and Isaiah brought that people unto God, and he saved them in such a great deliverance. So, this section, this verse section, it can't be exclusively given to the Assyrians. So therefore it's natural to think of it as applying perhaps in its greater fulfilment to the Babylonians. Alright. But then when the Romans came along and did even more than what the Babylonians even did, and some 700 years later, wouldn't it be very much more natural again to say, well indeed this is an application of the prophecy?
Undoubtedly that's true. And therefore I'm sure that in chapter 24, increasingly, the disciples and Israel would have seen the application of this chapter to their own circumstances, as those three terrible invasions came upon the land by Assyrian, Babylonian and Roman. Again in verse 12, there's mention made of the city. In the city is left desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction. Why is the gate mentioned? What's the reference that you automatically remember about the gate? Who will possess the gate of his enemies? Where's the expression from? Come on. He will possess the gate of his enemies? Thank you, Dan. 22 and verse 17. Thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. So when the gate is smitten with destruction, that's equivalent to saying the whole place has been overrun. The gate, of course, was not just the place that opened the city, but inside that was the marketplace. And so, you know, the place of meeting, the very soul of that city, was overrun and taken and in the hands of others. On this occasion, it was smitten with destruction. So the government of the city was overrun by the invader. Desolation had come to stay. In the city is left desolation. You know that word desolation is the word shamar. If you turn to Ezekiel chapter 48, the city is given the title Yahweh Shema. In Ezekiel 48 and verse 35, it was round about 18,000 measures. And the name of the city from that day shall be Yahweh is there. And if you see the margin, it says Yahweh Shema. Now that's an interesting little play. Some Hebrew words can have very distinct alternative meanings. There's a classic illustration of it. Isaiah had said, in the city is left desolation. And yet there's another time when that word Shema is used, and there it can mean Yahweh is there. he is in existence in that city. So the two situations of that city are poignantly brought together in the one word. And do you remember, my dear brothers and sisters, though apparently I didn't make it altogether clear, how that Joel was making many statements that were very similar in Joel chapter 1 to what Isaiah was saying. Just have a look at that again. For in those latter part of that first section, say from verse 7 down, there was a lot of mention about the new wine mourning, about the vine languishing. There was no joy. Mirth of Tabrets ceased. People felt like trying to solace their terrible anguish with some wine of pleasantness. They shall not drink wine with a song. Strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. There is a crying, verse 11, for wine in the streets. All joy is darkened. The mirth of the land is gone. Almost exactly what Joel was saying in Joel chapter 1, verse 5. The new wine is cut off from your mouth. Verse 7, he hath laid my vine waste and barked my fig tree. He hath made it clean bare and cast it away. The branches thereof are made white. The field is wasted, verse 10. There's our word again. The land mourneth. There's again Isaiah 24. But the corn is wasted. The new wine is dried up. The oil languisheth. Be ye ashamed, O ye husbandmen. How, O ye vine dressers, for the wheat and for the barley, because the harvest of the field is perished. The vine is dried up and the fig tree languisheth. There's the very words, isn't it? End of that verse. Because joy is withered away from the sons of men. So those two prophets are very strikingly in unison at that time. I would say that's a case for saying that Joel comes after Isaiah. All right, so we return to Isaiah chapter 24, and our next section is verses 13 to 16. Now, have you all got a copy of those headings? They've all been handed out, have they? Now, the heading says, a remnant sing praises to Yahweh from east to west for their salvation. All right, let's just read those verses. It's really lovely to read this chapter again tonight. Always interesting to read it right through, isn't it? When thus it shall be in the midst of the land. Right, well, that's a time of great destruction, isn't it? When thus it shall be in the midst of the land, Israel has suffered greatly. After Assyrians, Babylonians, and after Babylonians, Romans. AD 70. There shall be as the shaking of an olive tree, and as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done. They, the remnant, the gleaned grapes, they shall lift up their voice. They shall sing for the majesty of Yahweh. They shall cry aloud from the sea. Wherefore glorify ye Yahweh in the fires, even the name of Yahweh Elohim of Israel, in the isles of the sea. So a voice of praise to the God of Israel is found in the isles of the sea. When was ever heard such a thing? This is a remarkable and wonderful statement. From the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous. In fact, it should be, as in the original Hebrew, the righteous one. See? Well, there was no joy, verse 11. There was no singing, verse 8. But there is now. Not in the land, but out there, in all the countries beyond. Israel has suffered greatly, but God's work has gone on. And so I'm putting to you, my dear friends, that the understanding of this section is that a remnant have been saved and sing praises to Yahweh from east to west, if you like, from one end of the earth to the other. That's just another way of saying east and west, isn't it? You know, north is up there, isn't it? South is down here, so to speak. You can pinpoint north, but you can never pinpoint west, can you? Because if you're in Canada, then west is where? It's the Pacific, and it's Russia. But if you're in Australia, Russia's towards the east, isn't it? So it depends where you are, doesn't it? You never catch up with the east, and you never catch up with the west, but you do north or south. So if you say a thing is from east to west, you're saying it's round the world. And that's the concept here portrayed. The whole world has evidenced this note of praise that has come after the calamity. And when you think about that, and we stand back now with a very great advantage, don't we? Because we've seen all that history. We know what happened after the Romans, the Babylonians and the Assyrians put to flight the people of Israel. We know what happened. They were scattered. There was a faithful remnant. And that remnant also joined with another scattered people who from that time to what the rest of this chapter describes, have been a people that have been like fires, like lights around the world, and have lifted up, as they do tonight, their note of praise to God. Even though Israel has failed and its city has been destroyed, yet nevertheless there's been a people that have felt the resurgence of the hope of Israel, and they have worshipped the Lord God of Israel, even though his people were scattered and his city was desolate. That makes sense, doesn't it? I think it makes a lot of sense to understand this section in that way. And so what will follow after that will be a statement of the terrible plight of the world at the end of the time of the Gentiles. All right? So let's just stand back to the chapter. What we're saying is, in the first 12 verses, we have the plight of Israel as invasion and destruction hit upon it. Then we have, in the middle section, a description of another people, first described as gleaning grapes, that even despite that calamity, they, in lands afar, have been able to lift up their voice to God with thanksgiving. And then comes the end. The times of the Gentiles are completed. The day is finished, and the world is seen in terrible turmoil. The earth, verse 20, shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage, and the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise. And the judgments of God come principally upon the great of the earth. It shall come to pass in that day, verse 21, that Yahweh shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. And then Christ and the saints, see verse 23, your heading, Christ reigning in Jerusalem in glory with the saints. Then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed when Yahweh of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before his ancients gloriously. So there you've got the Lamb and the 144,000 with him on Mount Zion, haven't you? That's the same picture. It's Revelation, the book of Revelation. We've called this, haven't we, the little apocalypse. And there you can hear the overtures very beautifully, can't you? As Yahweh of hosts, represented in his son, is there reigning in Mount Zion together with his elders or ancients in glory with him. So that's a remarkable chapter, isn't it? Feel generally happy with that as a structure and understanding of the chapter? All right, keep your hand there. Have a look at this. Luke chapter 21. Now you'll see the grounds for our project. I hope that many of you have been thinking thoughtfully about the project. It's got very real interest in it. If you can master it and do it well, you'll really enjoy it. Mark it up too in your Bible so you've got the permanent benefit. Look at Luke 21. After the little description about the widow with the two mites, verse 5. You've got the statement about the temple. And then there is a long dissertation up to verse 23 about the plight of Israel and the signs that would lead to the capture of the city. They shall lay their hands on you, verse 21, and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prisons. And ye shall be betrayed, verse 16, both by parents and brethren. There will be a time of, verse 11, of great earthquakes and divers places and famines and pestilences, fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. Nation shall rise against nation. Wars and commotions, verse 9. And that goes on, verse 20. When you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. The city is desolate, says Isaiah 24. See the little echoes? I know it could come also from Daniel chapter 8, but nevertheless there's an echo to Isaiah 24. There's something for your project. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. These be the days of vengeance, verse 22. But vengeance isn't upon Israel. It's not a worldwide vengeance at this point. Woe unto them that are with child, verse 23. Verse 24, they shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles. Full stop. So that is equivalent to our first 11 verses of Isaiah 24. Now verse 25. There shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars and upon the earth distress of nations. What did Isaiah say? He said, this moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed. So we've got the same kind of language again. Distress of nations with perplexity. So from the localized scene of Jerusalem's incarceration by the Romans and the scattering of that people to all nations, we now have a worldwide scene, which of course is our days. Men's hearts, verse 26. Failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then you've got to verse 29, the reference to the fig tree and all the trees, when they now shoot forth. And the 27th chapter of Isaiah has perhaps the grandest description of the fig tree as shooting forth, or the vine shooting forth. Israel shall blossom and bud, says Isaiah, and fill the earth with fruit. It's an outstanding prophecy. Undoubtedly, Jesus would have had those words in mind there. Verse 33, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. And that's got echoes again in Isaiah 24. Take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and cares of this life, and so that day come upon you unawares. For as a snare shall it come on all them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. And all that language is all very much akin to Isaiah 24. So what we've got in Isaiah 24 is the Old Testament, Luke 21. It's the Old Testament, if you like. We call this the Olivet Prophecy, don't we? So in Isaiah 24, we've really got that same structure that we have in the prophecy of our Lord Jesus in Luke 21. Any questions on that? It's a general picture. Seemed to fit. You're happy with that. Goes right through to the kingdom. Israel's demise. Saints take up the call. They sing of their salvation in the lands afar. Then the Gentiles' demise. And out of that the saints are picked up and the Lord comes to reign in Jerusalem as king over all the earth, when the kings of the earth are bound together in prison. It's a wonderful chapter, isn't it? The whole panorama is there. All right, now returning to verse 13. Happy? When thus it shall be in the midst of the land among the people, there shall be as the shaking of an olive tree, and as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done. I suppose most of us are familiar with what's meant by the gleanings, but just in case, come back quickly to the two references in Deuteronomy chapter 24. I suppose it's the story of Ruth that tells us most about the gleanings, but she did it, of course, with grain in the field. But in Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 20 and 21, it outlines it a bit more broadly than that. But when thou beatest thine olive tree, thou shalt not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. And when thou gatherest the grapes of thy vineyard, thou shalt not glean it afterward. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. And so Isaiah says that after this invasion of the land has taken place, that there will be as the shaking of an olive tree and as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done. And so he's using the terms of Deuteronomy chapter 24. Just another reference in the book of Leviticus, chapter 19. Verse 9 and 10. And when ye reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field, neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest. And thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and stranger. I am Yahweh your God. As I provide for you, therefore, the least you can do is to provide that little bit for your own poor people among you. It's a beautiful provision, wasn't it? Now, if you come back to Isaiah, it's not the first time that he's used this language. As a matter of fact, of course, this concept of the saving of the remnant is a very great concept in his whole book, isn't it? But firstly, Isaiah 17 and verse 6. The glory of Jacob, this was speaking about, do you remember verse 4? In that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. It shall be as when the harvest man gathereth the corn and reapeth the ears with his arm, and it shall be as he that gathereth ears in the valley of Rephaim, yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it, as the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top of the utmost bough, four or five in the utmost fruitful branches thereof, saith Yahweh, God of Israel. And if you've ever been knocking olives in your earlier years of life, you'll know just how true that is. You can have a very fruitful bough, and it's out there, and big olives on the end of it. And because they're big ones, you want to hit them, and so you bang, 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 you can't get them. Everything else falls down, but there's still half a dozen left up there, or ten or whatever, and you're trying as much as you can to try and knock them, to eventually you probably give it away because it's too much effort for too little. But you see, the poor would come and he'd keep beating and he'd have something from those. That's exactly the picture which is now being portrayed in the 24th chapter. It's the shaking of an olive tree, the last remaining features of the fruit. Now, this is then the concept, isn't it? The concept of the remnant, which of course is a great part of Isaiah's prophecy. He had two sons. One of those sons had a name that signified, didn't it, this doctrine of the remnant. Which child was that? He had two sons. He only had two sons. Do you want another chance? It was Shear Jashub, wasn't it? Sorry, Pete, but it was. Mahushal and Hashbaz means hasten of spoil, hasten to pray. Shear Jashub, which meant a remnant shall return. And chapter 10 is perhaps the classic statement of this doctrine. In Isaiah 10 and verse 20. Isaiah 10 verse 20. Mark, would you like to read that for us? Through to verse 22, please. Oh, I got the wrong mark last time, didn't I? I'll specify this mark this time and you'll be ready next time.
It shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel and such as are escaped from the house of Jacob shall no more again stay upon him that smote them, but shall stay upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel in truth. The remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet a remnant of them shall return. The consumption decree shall overflow with righteousness.
Right. So that's good. That's exactly his doctrine, isn't it? That to whatever happens, a remnant would return. And then, of course, in Hezekiah's day, it was that faithful remnant that had the good nous to get inside the city. The doctrine then was, get inside the city. And it was what God said, not the walls. It was because he said that would be the place. You get inside the walls, but in this one,
It was the opposite. Do you remember? Jesus said, don't get into this city. If you're out in the country, stay there and go. Don't come into the city. See, it's what God had said was the place that you should be. And so a remnant was saved on both occasions if they did what God said. All right. So that's this great doctrine of Isaiah, that a remnant would be saved. Now we come back then to Isaiah 24. And he says in verse 14, after speaking of this few olives left, this few grapes left, they shall lift up their voice. And I think the logic of that is that that's the grapes. It's the few olives that are left, isn't it? In other words, it's the remnant. They shall lift up their voice. They shall sing for the majesty of Yahweh. They shall cry aloud from the sea. So there's a very beautiful concept, isn't it? That whilst there's been terrible judgments, that nevertheless this remnant is saved because they establish themselves on the word of God, are therefore singing with very great delight and thankfulness to God for all that he has done for them. What a magnificent contrast is intended, therefore. Don't miss it. Put it in your margin. Don't miss the contrast that is intended between verses 13 to 16 and the previous verses. It's a dramatic contrast written into the record that we might see that the work of God goes on despite the judgment, despite Israel. In the 42nd chapter, we have a passage that is very akin to this one. Yahweh's servant is introduced in verses 1 to 4. He makes a covenant. Verse 6, I, Yahweh, have called thee in righteousness and will hold thine hand and will keep thee and give thee for a covenant of the people for a light of the Gentiles, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison and them that sit in darkness out of the prison house. In other words, they sat in the prison of death. They were mortal people locked in immortality and had no hope until this servant of Yahweh came. But now God's made a covenant with them to open their blind eyes, to loose the bonds of the prison. I am Yahweh, that is my name, and my glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. Behold, the former things have come to pass, and new things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. And of course, it would be the Apostle Paul that would use these words with the message going to the Gentiles. And now verse 10. Sing unto Yahweh a new song, and his praise from the end of the earth. There's a far greater inclusion than just the nation of Israel. The message has gone out, and so from the ends of the earth there is heard a message of thankfulness unto God. That's us, my dear brothers and sisters, written in the record. Way down in Australia, way down in the bottom of Australia, we are still able to give him thanks and praise for all that he has done, having been incorporated, though we're a people so far off and may well have been forgotten, yet we've been graciously incorporated. And so we come, as on this night and other occasions, and sing unto Yahweh a new song, inspired by the message of hope. And his praise from the end of the earth, ye that go down to the sea. That's what Isaiah says in his 24th chapter. And all that is therein, the isles, it's another expression, again of chapter 24. The isles of the sea, verse 15 of chapter 24. Let the wilderness and the cities thereof lift up their voice, verse 11. The villages that Kedar doth inhabit. Let the inhabitants of the rock sing. Let them shout from the top of the mountains, from the sea to the very tops of the mountains, from east to west, across the world. Let them give glory unto Yahweh and declare his praise in the islands. Isn't that beautiful? Well, that's the same prophet, a very similar picture there described. Now, there's a few technicalities, if we come back to chapter 24, just to iron out here. It says, they shall lift up their voice, verse 14. We understand that now. They shall sing
for the majesty of Yahweh. We understand that. They shall cry aloud from the sea. Brother Hammond, the RSV, put, instead of the sea, they put the west. I suppose rather obviously, because if you're living in Israel, the sea's on the west, isn't it? It's the Mediterranean Sea. And so the Revised Standard Version and Rotherham have, instead of the sea, they have the west. Well, it is actually in the Hebrew the word sea, but I'm sure that is the sense, from the west, see, even though the Hebrew actually is the word sea. And we had that in the 42nd chapter, didn't we? Then in verse 15, continuing on in the same vent, it says, "Wherefore glorify ye Yahweh in the fires." What do you think that might mean? Well, I think the parallel expression leads us to it, because it then goes on to say, "Even the name of the Lord God of Israel in the isles of the sea." Let's take that phrase first, the isles of the sea, then we'll come back to the word fires. The isles of the sea is used many times in Isaiah. We saw it there in the 42nd chapter already. But come to the 49th chapter. It always has reference to the lands of the Gentiles. You see, Israel were not really related to their coast. Have you ever thought how strange it was that they had no major ports? Israel had no major ports down the Mediterranean coast. They've struggled even today to do that, but they never, because God didn't really want them to have that. He didn't want them linked up with all the nations of the world. There was the Phoenicians, but they're up further, see? But they weren't on the coast of Israel. They could have dominated the seas. Solomon did at one stage, have a fleet of ships that linked him with Tarshish, but that was unique. Normally speaking, they did not cross themselves. They did not correlate with the nations of the world. God didn't want that. However, in Isaiah 49, where we have a prophecy of the Apostle Paul bearing the name of Christ to the Gentiles, we read in verse 1, "Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from far." And wherever you get that little expression, "from far," it has reference to the Gentiles at large. And so verse 6, halfway through that verse, it says, "I will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth." All right. So Isaiah 42 and Isaiah 49 and quite a lot of others make very clear reference to the isles of the sea as referring to the Gentile peoples. So we return now to our 24th chapter. If the sea is on the west, and the understanding is that these voices of praise and joy and thanksgiving are coming from all parts of the compass, then in verse 15, where we read, "Wherefore glorify ye Yahweh in the fires," it wouldn't be surprising, would it at all, to find that the RSV has translated that by the word east. So also the Revised Version has got the east. And in fact, it's the word that we find in another context. It's the word Urim. All right? Urim. Which means lights. Lights. You'd like to see it. And the east, of course, is where the light comes, isn't it? It comes in the morning from the east. So it's natural to think of that as the place where light arises, as the direction of the lights that come in the morning, as I saw them yesterday morning, very beautifully, that unspeakable joy of dawn, very beautiful thing indeed, as God brings up the light and it dispels the darkness. So when we look then at verse 14 and 15 together, clearly the sense is from the sea, from the west, glorify Yahweh in the fires in the east. In the east and in the west, the faithful remnant are magnifying the name of Yahweh. It's a very formal declaration. Yahweh Elohim of Israel. This people are above all the idolatry that's in those parts. And the God that had hitherto been worshipped in the thin strip of land in the Eretz Israel is now being worshipped by a people scattered indeed, but nevertheless from east to west. A very glorious concept. So verse 16 puts it in very plain language and says, from the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous one, as it is in the Hebrew. And again, the RSV comes good and puts it just as that. Capital R for righteous, capital O for one. To the righteous one. And that song of praise is coming from the uttermost part of the earth. Have we heard these songs? What songs, my dear and sisters? What are they singing? Well, within the context of this little apocalypse, as we call it, from chapter 24 to 27, there are songs. Look at chapter 25, verse 1. There's a song. I'd like to read that for us, Mark 2. It's not a Jaguar. But... Yes, there are songs in this section of the record. What about chapter 26 or chapter 25, verse 9? It shall be said in that day, lo, this is our God, we have waited for him, and he will save us. This is Yahweh, we have waited for him. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. That's how we feel now, isn't it? One of our hymns has those very words in it, doesn't it? And we've been doing that for many years. Waiting for the time when it will break out as though it was a new song, even though it's been sung many times before. Chapter 26. Dan, would you like to read chapter 26, verse 1 to 4? Here's another song.
In that day shall this song be sung that they included. We have a strong city. Salvation will come according to all walls and all walls. Open ye the gates that the righteous nation which keep the truth. I will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on them, because he trusted in them. Trust ye in Yahweh forever, for in Yahweh is everlasting strength.
Yeah. That's another little song that's already been composed. The words are there. Many people have already sung it, but when they sing it in immortality, they will sing it yet afresh, won't they? The 26th chapter again, verse 19 says, thy dead man shall live, together with my dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust. For thy dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. So out of all the morosity of the earlier description of desolation and invasion and judgment, there nevertheless comes an ongoing evidence of the work of God around the earth. The light of the truth is not put out. Now, you take, for example, Paul's little comment in Philippians, how he describes the ecclesia. This ecclesia in Philippi is but typical, isn't it? It's another little light in the hills. After this last week, we have now the Mount Barker ecclesia, another little light in the hills, another little fire set on a hill to bring forth light to the world. In Philippians chapter 2, we read in verse 15, that ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ. There it is, my dear brothers and sisters. Wherefore glorify ye Yahweh in the fires, in the east, in the lights, even the name of Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, in the isles of the sea. All right, coming back now then to chapter 24 again. This wonderful sense of joy and ongoing purpose of God. Beginning, of course, in the remnant of Israel and spreading from them to another remnant, the remnant that have come out from the Gentiles at large. So verse 16, from the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous one, speaking in praise of the one who has redeemed them and thanking God daily for that provision. And then the tone changes, altogether changes. And Isaiah puts a personal comment. He says, "But I said, my leanness, woe unto me. The treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously." It's dramatic language, isn't it? Moving away from the picture of worldwide praise that's coming from these little lights and fires around the world through this period of time, Isaiah now is bearing the burden of a heavy message of judgment. And he feels that. The RSV says again, "I pine away, I pine away. My leanness, I pine away." As he feels the pressure of that which is coming upon him, he's bearing all the sense of awe and wonder and of judgment and punishment that is involved in the words. And he sees in verse 16, at the end of that verse, he sees how evil the world is. That word treacherous means exactly that. And when it says dealers, it means people dealing treacherously with each other, with their wives, with people that they come in contact with, with God himself, breaking his covenant, like the people of the world in which we're dealing. It's a treacherous society, isn't it? That will turn its hand from good to evil at the turn of a button. They have no concern about the things of God. Fidelity and faithfulness have gone. And so Isaiah is feeling that, my dear brothers and sisters. But it's after this time, you see, of the earlier verses. And so it would be natural, therefore, to take it on to a later time. And I'm sure it is a later time, like Luke 21 puts it in those sequence of times. And then he says, verses 17 to 20, "Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth." That's again Eretz. Fear and the pits and the snare. And in the Hebrew, there's a little bit of playing going on, because the first word
is the word pakeh. Pakeh. And the second word is the word, I think it's pakeh.
But it is
pack. And the third word is the word pack again. I think that's actually an H. I'll just check.
Yeah, they're all H's.
So you can see the Hebrews having a little play upon this. There's an assonance, as it's called, where the words are growing in tempo, but they've actually got a similar echo in the Hebrew if they were sung.
If we could say it in Hebrew, we would feel that coming out. Pakad and the pakan and the pak are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth. What did it mean by that? Fear and the pit, fear and the pit and the snare. Verse 18 describes that, and it says, "It shall come to pass that," here's the first one, 1, 2, 3 in verse 17, now here's the first one in verse 18, "It shall come to pass that he who flees from the noise of the fear," so he flees racing away from this terrible sense of fear that this great noise has gendered in him, "but alas, he falls into the pit." That's the pakam. And he pulls himself out of the pit with all great difficulty. He that cometh out of the midst of the pit then is taken in the snare. He runs into a trap which has been let, and his foot is caught in the trap. And then it says, "For the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake." What's the sense of that? It doesn't matter where you go, or what you do, or how hard you try, you're gone. You're caught. That's what it's saying, isn't it? And here's a man who's clever enough to run away from the fear, and he thinks he's going to escape. He falls into the pit, and he's got strength enough to get out of that, and away he goes again. Lo and behold, his foot's caught in a snare. So it's a sense of what? To use a New Testament term, a Luke 21 term. No way out. And I'm absolutely certain that the Lord has this passage in mind when he uses that expression. If you turn to Luke chapter 21, can you hear any other echoes of that direct language? It says in verse 25, upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity. With perplexity. And that word perplexity is the word aporia. And aporia simply means no passage out. Without a passage out. We often hear it in the lecture, but perhaps if I put it on the board, you'll be able to put it alongside your heart. With perplexity. Equals aporexia. And this means no or without. And that means a passage. A way of escape, see? So aporexia means there's nowhere to go. Like when you look down the tunnel and there's no light there. What do you do? Sometimes life's like that, isn't it? And you've got a great quandary upon you and you just don't know what to do. It's just greater than you can bear and you don't know where to go, which direction to go. Everything seems to be just clothed with doom and distress. And that's what this is saying. That the world is going to find that it's just like that. A time where there's just no way to escape. Now, I say that I think that comes from Isaiah 24, because look at verse 35. For as a snare shall it come on the face, come on all them that dwell on the face of the earth. That word earth is the equivalent to the word eretz. It's the word GE, and it means land. That's exactly what it means. It doesn't mean particularly one land, but it means land, eretz. It's going to come on the face of the whole earth. And when the judgments of God hit, my dear brothers and sisters, that's how it's really going to be. You know, some wiser people feel that now, don't they? You'll speak to somebody from time to time, and they really say to you, look, I don't know where the dickens the world is going. There are some people who can see that now, aren't there? Not many, and the number, percentage is growing less. But there are people who can see that now, that the foundations are gone. You know, you say, well, this is what might need to be done, the person will say, but you know, the horse has bolted. They can see already that there's not in the earth men of stature or principles or decency. There's not a latent sense of principle in the world anymore, is there? It's just not there. If a government stood up and said, look, we're going to have decency in marriage and decency in family life again, they'd be out on their neck. But we wouldn't get to the next election. They'd just be tossed out within a short time. Couldn't do it. And really, there is no way, is there, for this world to go ahead. It just cannot go ahead while the foundations of morality are so deeply undermined. So I'm quite sure, and that's just another little bit for your project, that's what Jesus is taking his cue from when he has that prophecy in Isaiah chapter 24. All right, now returning back to the prophet, this sense, my dear brothers, of multiplying incidents of calamity is mirrored by another passage in Amos. Would you like just to have a look at that one very quickly? In Amos chapter 5, we have another similar series of events. Again, it's a triad of calamities. In Amos 5 and verse 19, as if a man did flee from a lion and a bear met him, or went into the house and leaned his hand on the wall and a serpent bit him. He couldn't get it right, could he? Didn't matter what he did, he was a goner. And so Amos was putting that in a very dramatic way, and Isaiah's done it exactly the same way. No way out. All right. Coming down then Isaiah 24 again. The same sense is found there at the end of verse 18. In what way, my dear brothers and sisters? Well, there it says, verse 18 of Isaiah 24, there it says, for the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. Can you see the sense of that? It's coming down on top of you. It's coming up from beneath you. Everything's gone, you see. It's the same picture in just a different way. Top or bottom, from the heavens or from the earth, everywhere is just gone. There's nowhere to go. There is no refuge. It's desolation from either side. It's dramatic, isn't it? Very dramatic language. And of course, those words, for the windows from on high are open, they take us back, don't they, to that signal and great devastation that God made in the earth in Genesis. In Genesis chapter 7, we have the same expression. Genesis chapter 7. And in verse 11. Alec, would you like to read for us Genesis 7 and verse 11? Yes, and 8 verse 2, Al, please. All right, so there we've got that expression. Of course, it would have brought back that sense of historic desolation. This is an historic desolation, the collapse of the Gentile world. And so it's described in terms of the Noachic flood as the Lord Jesus did, as it was in the days of Noah. He invoked the same comparison. See that? That's Luke 17. So, you know, they're all here together again. And then it says at the end of verse 18, and the foundations of the earth do shake. That would tend to suggest an earthquake, which of course is promised, isn't it? In Genesis, in Zechariah 14 and verse 4, there is promised that there will be a great earthquake at that time. But I don't think it's just a literal earthquake that's involved in verse 18. The sense is that the whole world has come unhinged. The centre, it cannot hold. Now in verse 19, that is dramatically portrayed with other words. It says, the earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage, and the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. Now some people have used these words to say, well, the earth's going to be burnt up like the Seventh Day Adventists say, and it won't be there again. See, not for inhabitants to use it anymore. But how would you reply to that? Well, if that's literal, what about verse 23? You see, the whole thing is figurative, isn't it? Ecclesiastes 1 verse 4, always a helpful verse, says that the earth abideth forever. So just put a little note there, lest somebody frame that to you as evidence that the earth itself, as such, is going to be destroyed. By the way, that word earth, all through verse 19 and 20, is the word eretz. So, there is a great calamity, therefore, coming upon the earth in these terms, and it's inescapable. So verse 20,
bright. The words moved exceedingly at the end of verse 19. He was accused of his apparatus.
That's right, yeah. Good. Did everybody get the point of that? It's this word.
Septuagint was translated into
The Old Testament translated into Greek, and they used that word aphorexia. All the more reason, you see, why Jesus would have been quoting from here. Get the power of that down. It's terrific. It's a real key point. There's something for your project. Don't miss it. It's a really interesting series of thoughts. All right, verse 20 has also got a bit of Luke 21 in it. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard and shall be removed like a cottage. You know, Jesus said at the end of his warnings, the earth's going to be like a drunkard. He said what? In his warnings, take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and cares of this life, and so that day come upon you unawares. And of course, here in verse 20, it's more than the effects of drink. It's a description. But drink and the life that goes with it is very much related to the reason the world is like it is, isn't it? The earth is reeling to and fro like a drunkard. And then it says it shall be removed like a cottage, like a hut, says the RSV and other translations, like a hut. And that has reference to what might be left behind in the vegetable patch. When the toiler in the field, he may want a little hut for some kind of protection during the heat of the day where he might find a rest, or he may stay there overnight if his house is some distance away. Same word is used in Isaiah 1 and verse 8. The daughter of Zion is left as a cottage in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. That word lodge is the same word that we have back here in Isaiah 24 verse 20. The word cottage there in verse 8 of chapter 1 is the word booth, and you all know what that means. Israel brought in booths, didn't they? So it was a fabricated simple structure, and so the earth now is being spoken of as being removed like a cottage. Why? A good wind at any time would clean it up, and that's how God sees the earth this time. The reason? The transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. All right. Now verse 21 and 22. It shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. This is very, very similar to chapter 2. Quickly turn, if you would, to chapter 2, which also speaks of a shattering earthquake. So we can link that up with verse 19. The earth is utterly broken down. Foundations of the earth do shake. This chapter 2 is the chapter of the great earthquake, in which God says, verse 11, the lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and Yahweh alone shall be exalted in that day. Repeat it again in verse 17. That's the theme of that last half of chapter 2. So Isaiah's on the same theme again. The haughty people of the earth do languish indeed. That was his expression in verse 4 of the same chapter, where we applied it to Israel. Now we're applying it on a worldwide basis. Put in simple terms, the kings of the earth are judged upon the earth at the end of verse 21. So there's the high ones, they are the kings of the earth. Verse 22 describes that they shall in fact be placed in prison. They shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days shall they be visited. There is a classic quotation to go alongside that. It's found in the Psalms, one that's often referred to when describing the work of the saints. Psalm 149. Verse 4, beautiful words, very similar sentiment, very similar. Take verse 4,
It's a time of singing. Let them sing praises unto him with the timbrel and harp. Verse 4, for Yahweh taketh pleasure in his people. He will beautify the meek with salvation. Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. That's now, my dear brothers and sisters. Isaiah may well be taking it from this, eh? Let the saints be joyful in glory. That's his very expression. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth and a two-edged sword in their hand to execute vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the peoples, plural, to bind their kings with chains. That's what Isaiah is talking about. And their nobles with fetters of iron to execute upon them the judgment written, dishonour have all his saints. And so Isaiah closes his chapter with the saints in honour. Verse 23, Isaiah 24. Then the moon shall be confounded, which is used as a figure of the religious systems in all their height and glory and all their influence. The moon shall be confounded, whether it's the religion of Israel or the religion of the Gentiles. It's confounded and has no answers. When God has shaken the whole system and every cathedral's in ruins, how will they be able to answer this so great a calamity? And the sun ashamed, the ruling power of the world. There is no government that can raise a note of direction. There is no government that can answer the greatness of the calamity that has come upon them. They are ashamed. Like as when the sun is eclipsed, the moon confounded and the sun eclipsed. Because there's a greater sun that has arisen, the sun of righteousness, when Yahweh of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem. He didn't call it that, did he? Back in verse 10, where he called it the city of confusion. Confusion is a term related to Babylon, but there it was related to Jerusalem. Now it has returned to its glory. It's not the city of desolation either in verse 12. Because there's a different sort of Shema there. It's Yahweh is there. He is there indeed. When Yahweh and hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem. And he's not alone. And before his ancients gloriously. Now that word ancients is in the Septuagint, the word elders. Right? It's the word elders. What is the Greek word for elders? Septuagint puts it in the Greek, right? We all know. Come on, tell me what the word for elders is. Presbytery, yes. That's the Greek word. And when the Septuagint translates this word ancients across, that's the word it uses. Alright, tell me a beautiful context. In the New Testament, where the word elders plus federo is used. Beautiful context. Exactly the same as this. I quoted it before. Revelation. Beautiful context. It's absolutely the same picture. Sorry? Chapter 4, yes, that's right. Some lady down the front's done quite well tonight. Revelation chapter 4 and verse 10. Look at this, my dear brothers. Talk about one book, eh? Look at this. The 24 presbyteroi. That's our word. The 24 elders fall down before him that sat on the throne. He shall reign in Mount Zion and worship him. That's exactly what they do. That liveth forever and ever, and cast their crowns before the throne, saying, Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honour, reigning before his ancients gloriously, is the very expression of Isaiah. Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honour and power, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created. Chapter 7. Same picture, verse 11. They cried with a loud voice, verse 10, Salvation to our God which sitteth upon the throne and upon the Lamb. And all the angels stood round about the throne and about the elders. The throne and the elders and the Lord is there, isn't it? It's all their same picture. And the four beasts and fell upon the throne, on their faces and worship God, saying, "Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honour and power and might be unto our God forever and ever. Amen." So we truly have one book, don't we? The vision never faints, it just grows brighter as we go through the book. Thank you.